Welcome to Stutter Talk. This is your host, Chris Constantino, and my guest today is Dr. Walt Manning, who is a professor at the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders at the University of Memphis. Dr. Manning is the author of over 100 articles, and his textbook, Clinical Decision-Making in Fluency Disorders, is now in its third edition. I am a PhD student in Communication Sciences and Disorders, also at the University of Memphis. Today, we will be talking about the presentations we will be giving at the International Fluency Association's 8th World Congress in Lisbon, Portugal. Stutter Talk is on the web at stuttertalk.com. The International Fluency Association can be found at the IFA.org. So welcome, Dr. Manning. How are you doing?
Nice to be here. I've done this with Peter a few times over the years, and it's always fun.
All right. So why don't we start by, I'm just going to introduce what the IFA is, and then you can talk about your pre-conference workshop that you're going to be giving. In 3 years, the International Fluency Association holds a World Congress where people who stutter and speech pathologists from all over the world are invited to get together and to learn about stuttering. And at this conference this year in Portugal, Dr. Manning will be giving a pre-conference workshop that he's going to tell us a little bit about.
Well, I'm pleased to be going to this conference. I went to the first one in Munich in 1994, and that was an absolutely wonderful experience. And I haven't made them all since then, but I've gone to maybe three or four conferences over the year, IFA conferences, and it's always fun to go. And it's always fun to see friends from around the world and see them again at those conferences. I was asked, along with some other people, to do a pre-conference workshop. And as I understand it, these are people who are fairly new to the field, maybe intermediate level of experience working with people who stutter. The audiences are limited to 50 people. And I think they're one of the reasons I was told they were holding it in Lisbon is so they could get a large contingent of people from South America as well as Europe to come to the meeting. So I'm looking forward to meeting and making some new friends from those parts of the world. There's three conference workshops. I believe they're each 3 hours long over a period of 2 days. The first two are on Saturday, the 4th of July. And I believe the one I'm doing is Sunday, the 5th of July. The two on the 4th of July are, well, the first one is done by Marie-Christine Franken and Ellen Laros. I believe you pronounce her last name. And their topic is on working with preschool stuttering children. And they have a lot of experience doing that in the Netherlands. The second one that same day on the 4th is titled Basic Skills in Working with the School-Aged Child with a Fluency Disorder. And these are two people from Michael Palin Center in London, Elaine Kelman and Sharon Millard, who are good friends who will do a fantastic job, I'm sure. And then I'm doing the one on the 5th, and that's titled Management of Stuttering with Adolescents and Adults. Again, each of these are three-hour workshops, and looking forward to doing it.
Great. So your workshop is the last one, correct?
Right. Mine, the one on Sunday.
All right. And on the website, you have mentioned that you'll be talking about three different things specifically. The first thing is the qualities of a successful therapeutic experience. The second bullet point was the characteristics of effective clinical decision making by experienced clinicians. And the third is the importance of our role as counselors for adolescents and adults who stutter. Can you talk a little bit about your first point, the qualities of a successful therapeutic experience?
In one of the studies we did several years ago with a former doctoral student of mine, Laura Plexico, we looked at individuals who's had a successful therapeutic experience and very closely related to that, a positive or an effective therapeutic alliance, and then those people who didn't have a very successful therapeutic experience and along with that, not a very ideal therapeutic alliance, which is a critical part of the most successful therapy programs. Some people had both. They had both unsuccessful and, fortunately, eventually a successful experience. So we'll talk about the aspects of that and how that worked out for them in both cases, but also how it made them feel about the experience of having a more or less successful therapeutic experience. And it's really quite interesting to see the comments that the people had about how they interacted successfully or not so successfully with clinicians. And I think it's informative for clinicians to give them a feel for how to approach the process. Of course, it's different for everybody that we see, which is kind of the most, one of the exciting parts of the therapeutic process. But I think that will be quite informative, particularly to new or newer clinicians.
So can you give us a working definition of what you mean by therapeutic alliance?
Well, it's, in my understanding of it, I mean, it used to be called, when I was in school with my mentor, Gene Cooper at Penn State, he was very much into and interested in researching the therapeutic relationship. The therapeutic alliance is a kind of an elaborated version of that, and it's part of the work that Wampalt has done, Bruce Wampalt and his colleagues. Turns out the therapeutic alliance is a successful one, is a key aspect that indicates and predicts successful therapy. It's not so much the specific techniques of the therapeutic protocol, but one of the common factors across many different treatment approaches is a positive or a successful therapeutic alliance. And I should add to that, generally it's positive, but like many relationships, it can fluctuate. Sometimes we challenge our clients to do things they've avoided for maybe decades, and it's a difficult kind of thing to do, just like a parent does or a successful coach. Not every child or not every athlete appreciates some of the things their coaches make them do. But so same with therapy, I think. It's not always going to be a positive. It's going to be more of a dynamic relationship as you go through the sometimes difficult challenges of a therapeutic program. And so it's a really intriguing aspect of the therapeutic process, this dynamic interaction of the client and the clinician. One of the effective aspects of a good clinician is the ability to recognize and repair a ruptured therapeutic alliance, which sometimes happen when you push people too hard or they aren't ready to do things that you like them to try, not just in therapy, but in their daily environment. And so being sensitive and being able to measure, we'll talk about ways to do that, the nature of the therapeutic alliance and possibly repair one that's not going so well is an important part of that. I hope that answers it a little bit anyway.
Yeah. As you were saying all of that, I couldn't help but be reminded of the videos of Van Riper with Jeff, where he's giving Jeff therapy, and you watch as the alliance between them gets sort of tense at times, because Van Riper's giving Jeff sort of difficult tasks, but I think you've told me that he almost got or scared Jeff out of therapy.
Yeah, as I understand it, Barry Guitar's interview with him in the 20-year follow-up with Jeff Adams' act, but Jeff didn't come to therapy one time. Van Riper said some things that offended Jeff, even though, as Jeff said, they were very accurate, but they offended Jeff, and he dropped out of therapy for a week or two and then decided to come back. I know other people have had therapy with Van Riper, and he wasn't always this way, but he certainly pushed people hard, which is what he felt they needed to do in many cases. I had a former doctoral student that had therapy with him. Barry Guitar has talked about that. He could be pretty gruff, and when you first watch these tapes of Jeff and Barry Guitar, it looks like he's really kind of, besides being earthy as Van Riper was, being really quite challenging and really pushing these people pretty hard. But then, as Barry's mentioned to me, Barry Guitar, that when you watch these tapes over and over again over the years, or if you knew or ever met Van Riper at all, you'd appreciate the exceedingly humanistic perspective that he has, and the kind of the gentle side of that person too, because he, and it doesn't look so gruff and rough when you watch the tapes, but the first time or two, it's a little shocking to some clinicians.
Yeah, and I think he really sort of showcases that the Therapeutic Alliance it is not just about trying to be as positive as possible, that it's not just getting the person to like you. It's a lot more so subtle than that. And of course, it's going to, their perspective of you might go up and down as the challenges go up and down.
Yeah, in the 20-year follow-up tape where Barry interviews him, Barry said that a number of people had mentioned that he was being mean to you or really gruff or really very, very tough on you. And Jeff paused for a moment and he said, you know, I never really felt that way. I thought he was really sincerely trying to help me and doing the best thing for me. And so at least in retrospect, Jeff didn't feel that way.
Yeah. As you were discussing the Therapeutic Alliance, you mentioned that it was one of the key factors in the common factors model. Can you talk about some of the other factors?
Well, from the common factors model, again, this is in contrast to the medical model, where a strict medical model, at least, and it works better in many ways in the technological aspects of the medical field. There are certain techniques and certain procedures and possibly certain medications that would be the, based on evidence, would be the thing to do or the thing to administer. It's a little more difficult, I think, in the behavioral sciences. The research in common factors models have shown that it's not the specific techniques, although techniques are important, but it's the techniques don't explain success, or the particular therapeutic protocol, therapy A versus therapy B, really doesn't explain success. Therapy makes a difference versus no therapy, but across the successful therapeutic experiences, is the common factors are typically, as we talked about, number one, the therapeutic alliance. A second one would be the therapeutic allegiance to the program, that is, understanding the program, whether you developed it or the program you're at developed it or not, but understanding and having a rationale for what you're doing in therapy and a sense of direction in therapy, and then working the program and not giving up when it doesn't seem to be working particularly well with one person, but possibly modifying the program to meet that person's needs and the timing of therapy. So therapeutic allegiance to the program that you have used before and you're familiar with and you believe in, I think, is another important common factor. And lastly, maybe the most important one, or one of the other third most important one, is the experience and expertise of the clinician. And there's no substitute for experience. In it, you can spend a lifetime trying to get better at doing this, but expertise and therapeutic intuition and all the things that come with continuing to sharpen the saw all your life and become a better clinician is really never ending. But those people who are more experienced and work towards expertise in any area or any field are more likely to be able to improvise and adapt to the client's needs depending on how it's going in therapy.
Yeah. The third point from the website is the importance of our role as counselors for adolescents and adults who stutter. Can you talk about your approach to counseling?
Well, first of all, I think that you can't really talk about therapy without talking about counseling, regardless of the age of the person you're working with. You might be counseling the parents or the teachers or the spouse or good, you know, close family friends, etc. In the process, I don't think you can separate the therapeutic aspects of what you're doing from what most people would consider to be counseling. I think the essence of counseling probably starts with understanding the phenomena, or understanding, in this case, the experience of stuttering. Possibly harder for people to do who don't have a history of stuttering, although I'm sure there are people who have a history of stuttering that can't really describe or empathize with the experience. But for people who don't have a history of stuttering, it takes some paying attention to your clients, careful listening to your clients to understand, particularly the more subtle or beneath the surface aspects of stuttering. Everybody knows what the surface behaviors look and sound like for the most part, and things you can count pretty or relatively easily, although not as easily as it might seem. But to understand what's going on under the surface in terms of fear and anxiety and avoidance, and anxiety being a natural part of the stuttering experience. My students who don't stutter, who have to pose as stutters, have anxiety levels that are every bit as high as many people who stutter. But understanding things like how helpless it can be in moments where there's time pressure, or everybody's focusing on you. You have to introduce yourself to a group or at the beginning of the school semester and you stutter. Understanding the coping behaviors that people have in those situations that seem really neurotic or really bizarre sometimes, but are really understandable if you can experience the fear and loss of control that sometimes often goes along with being stuck in a moment of stuttering. So I think that's a big part of being able to be an effective counselor, is to understand that. And to, again, so much of counseling is just doing what we do with our friends, is just listening to them. We don't have to fix things. It takes the pressure off you as a therapist or a counselor if you appreciate the fact your job is not to fix these things. Your job is to understand and work with them, with your client, with their particular goals and directions they want to go in therapy. And really discover that kind of thing as you're going along. There's all kinds of different counseling approaches. The one that I am most at home with, for a number of different reasons that I'll explain during my presentation, is a kind of a constructivist narrative approach, understanding somebody's story and trying to alter the key themes of those stories so they can live a better quality of life. And improving fluency is a nice thing to do. I certainly appreciate my fluency, but that's only part of it. But I think you're more likely to have the desired level of fluency if you're also dealing with reconstruing who you are and reconstruing your understanding of the problem and your ability to do something about it. That's kind of a big overview of my idea of counseling during therapy, but I don't think we have any choice. If we're going to be effective, we have to also not so much do counseling techniques, but have a kind of a a position we're coming from as a counselor, where we're more than anything else willing to listen and understand.
Well, it sounds like counseling dovetails quite nicely into the common factors model, in terms of, we were just talking about the therapeutic alliance, and if you're not good at sort of at counseling and at sort of listening to your to the person who you're working with, I would imagine it would be more difficult to build that alliance. And also, the expertise of the clinician that we talked about being the other factor, or one of the other factors, I would imagine one of the things that comes with experience and expertise is more skills with counseling, because that's not something you can just sort of pick up from a textbook. It can really only be learned with experience.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I've had that said many times. You can read all these ideas and different perspectives and counseling techniques, but you really have to role play it, I think, and you really it has to be, as Luderman has talked about a lot, it has to be part of the conversation. I think it was Luderman that said that if your client realizes you're, quote, doing a counseling technique, you're not doing it right. It shouldn't stand out and be, oh, now we're doing this. And that's really kind of true in therapy for stuttering. It's like the focus shouldn't be on the technique. It should be on I'll talk about this in my presentation. It should be on the shared meaning. Why are we doing this technique? What's the rationale for it? Don't have to dovetail into a theory necessarily, but why are we doing this technique, and why are we doing it now, and what is the meaning of the technique? And it may not be always be so obvious, but and the client needs to understand that, his spouse needs to understand that, other people need to understand the rationale for what's going on here. And I think that's more important than the technique itself.
Yeah. And I think if you're conceptualizing what you're doing as counseling techniques, then you're probably greatly simplifying what it is that you're doing. Because if you're trying to take a cookie cutter approach and just insert certain techniques at certain times, it doesn't really lead to a cohesive therapy experience.
Yeah, I think the deep understanding that you can have, whether you are a clinician with a history of stuttering or not, and by the way, I've always wondered, there are a number of people in our field who don't have a history of stuttering. I think it would be an interesting study to maybe do a qualitative study to find out how it is that they understand so clearly and so deeply, and so I think so accurately, the lived experience of stuttering. Gene Cooper is an example. Scott Yars. Go on and on and on. There's a whole lot of people like that. And I've had people who stutter call me on the phone and get quite irate sometimes, saying that a clinician who doesn't stutter can't possibly understand stuttering. Well, it may be more difficult for them, but I know people who do. And one of them was my mentor and clinician, Gene Cooper. And I think it's a fascinating issue to find out how they can understand something that they haven't lived on a daily basis, but to understand it, at least in terms of general principles, so accurately. That's a fascinating issue, I think.
Yeah. I would imagine that the things that allow people to understand an experience that they have not had are the same sorts of skills that would lend themselves to making them a good counselor. They're the same sort of listening skills. Good summary of your pre-Krongis workshop. I want to now talk about two of the presentations that I'll be doing, and I'll be presenting work that I did under your guidance. And the first is called An Origin and Pawn Calculator, Determining Agency to Improve Treatment Outcomes. And this is work that you and I have been involved in that is really an extension of work that you've been doing for a number of years. So before we talk about what I've done with it, can we introduce the concept of origin and pawn scaling to begin with?
Yeah, this origin and pawn scaling technique, I was really told about it or found out about it, well, when Anthony DiLallo was here in his doctoral program, and he had read an article that was done in Australia about a scaling method that uses content analysis that seemed to be very sensitive and also a valid measure of looking at how somebody looks at themselves. It's not a whole lot different than things like self-esteem or self-efficacy or locus of control, which people have used to some degree, particularly locus of control, to indicate how people change from an external locus of control, for example, to a more internal kind of in charge locus of control as they go through therapy. And it's been used with some success, but not enough success to predict long-term success in therapy. Obviously, to some degree, the more fluent people get, the more likely they are to be successful, or the less, by some measure or measures, the less severe they are on the front end of therapy, the more likely they are to not relapse, which is a you know, human condition. Relapsing is something that happens a lot of the times after particularly intensive therapy programs. So you need to have follow-up going on. So you need to have follow-up going on after a therapy program. Locus of control was somewhat predictive, but not, we think, as predictive as what origin and pawn scaling could be. Here, it's a, instead of a single construct where, like with locus of control, you have either high externality and low internality or vice versa, here we have two separate dimensions scored, one being origins, meaning you're the origin of your actions, one being pawn, the other being pawn, where you're, what you do is just decided upon or influenced by others or the environment or the circumstances. So it's a little more subtle, but I think more sensitive indicator of somebody essentially having a voice. And that's especially helpful, I think, for anybody, but certainly people who stutter. That's, you know, the key line in the King's Speech, I think. Yes, I have a voice. And you hear this more and more now. It's possible to have a voice even though you stutter, and it's possible to have a voice whether you stutter a lot or whether you stutter a little. So that's the thing I've been absolutely fascinated with. And I think in terms of the goals of therapy, yes, you want to be more fluent. More significant than that, I think, is you want to be a good communicator, even if you do stutter. And I know lots of people who are like that. But at the base of it all, I think you want to develop an agentic lifestyle where you do what you need to do for yourself in a reasonable way, where you have a voice, in a, as they say in the literature, in a literal as well as a metaphorical sense. So that's what we're interested in, to predict increases in origin scores and corresponding decreases in pawn scores throughout therapy, but also following therapy. And some of the work that was also done on this, the first real scientific study that was done with it, was done by another doctoral student here, Kwon-Jae Lee, who's now back in Seoul, Korea. He showed that exactly that happens for not all, but about 80% of people who go through a successful therapy approach. Follow-up work we've done more recently with comparing origin and pawn scores for people who go through a successful therapy approach with typically fluent adult speakers. And we're more recently, that is not out in print yet, but that's quite telling in terms of what you might expect to see during therapy for somebody who stutters, but possibly also long-term as these origins and pawn scales normalize as a result of therapy and after therapy. So It's also another advantage besides the fact that it's a two-dimensional rather than a one-dimensional measure like locus of control or self-efficacy is that it's non-reactive. We simply ask people to talk about a recent speaking experience and then get origin of pawn scores. The problem with it so far, not so much for research but for clinical work, is that it's quite laborious and it takes some training to identify origin and pawn statements or clauses in somebody's, even a short 75 or 100 word sample. So Chris here has done the heavy lifting and developed a website that has a lot of potential. The accuracy at this point probably isn't approaching what humans can do with all their training. But that's our eventual goal, to be able to use this website. And I'll let Chris tell you more about that. But I think it's very exciting. It has a lot of potential for clinicians to be able to use this online website.
Yeah. So just like what Dr. Manning was saying, we saw a ton of potential in origin and pawn scaling. One of the reasons, just to echo Dr. Manning, of why we're so attracted to it is we see it as a measure of how agentic of a lifestyle a person can live. And for almost any condition that you would come in to receive therapy for, I think that the main outcome you're looking for is increased agency. You want to have choices in your life. You want to have a sense of freedom. And whatever condition that you've come in with is in some way limiting your choices or is limiting your freedom that you experience in your life. So we felt that this analysis technique was a good way of trying to get at that, as opposed to something sort of more superficial, like counting people's stutters or that kind of a thing. But the main problem with it was that it required people to be trained in doing the analysis. It was terribly time-consuming. And so it's not practical to be used in a clinic. And frankly, it's quite unenjoyable to do in a giant research study because it just takes a whole lot of time. So what we've done is we worked with a cognitive scientist by the name of Dr. Andrew Only, who's in our Institute for Intelligent Systems at the University of Memphis, and we've developed an online user interface that uses machine learning algorithms to automate the scoring process. So it takes out all of the training that would be involved in using this technique, and it's instantaneous. So you don't have to score every sentence individually. And yeah, so that's what our presentation is going to be about. Is we're going to be presenting our tool and talking about how it could be used in the clinic and in research. We're very excited about it currently. It isn't quite as accurate as a person would be scoring, but if we can collect more data, then the machine algorithm will continue to get more and more accurate, and hopefully we'll be approaching human scoring pretty soon. So I guess that is the nuts and bolts of the tool that we're developing. We see it as a way for clinicians to track treatment progress over time. Typically, during treatment, you would want to see an increase in origins statements and a decrease in pawns statements. And we would like to use this also to do your long-term treatment outcomes studies, because some of our past research has indicated that if people are leaving therapy with a significant increase in origin and a significant decrease in pawn statements, that they're more likely to show a long-term positive change after treatment. Interestingly, people who do not stutter, fluent speakers, don't have very many origin and pawn statements when they're talking about speaking. So we also have a feeling, and there was a recent study published this year, correct?
Yeah.
By you and Lee?
Yeah, it's coming out in the next month or so.
Okay. That it takes a look at origin pawn statements in fluent speakers versus people who stutter. And indeed, they don't really have that many origin or pawn statements. So we're thinking in the long term, we would want people who stutter probably to not be thinking about speaking in terms of an obstacle that they have to overcome, but just as any everyday thing that they'll be doing. And probably the best outcome would be, in the long run, low levels of origin and low levels of pawn statements.
Yeah, we were thinking originally the idea would be to have all these wonderfully positive origin statements. But it, as Chris was saying, it turns out that most people who don't have a history of stuttering have a lot of neutral statements. They just describe the speaking experience, but they don't assign a lot of essentially positive origin or more negative pawn statements to the experience. It's not a big deal. They just do it. And I think that coincides with that whole idea of feeling like you're in charge of your speech and things are flowing along and you don't really have to self-monitor or really work very hard to be speaking, which would be ideal, the kind of spontaneous speech we'd like, ideally, everybody would like to have. Not everybody who is typically fluent has it, but certainly people who stutter ideally eventually would like to be kind of spontaneous and not bang up against a wall every time they want to say something. So
yeah, it's kind of taking speaking out of the sphere of a challenging activity. If you talk about you're getting dressed in the morning, you're not going to talk about it as, you know, either very positively overcoming a challenge or very negatively getting defeated by your clothes. You're just going to talk about, you know, getting dressed. So we would like to see speaking sort of stop being something seen as so important in their lives. It's just something that can be an everyday spontaneous occurrence. It doesn't really have to be worried about.
That thought gave me another thought, another kind of metaphor. It's like eating a good meal. It shouldn't be that hard. It should be, you know, kind of enjoyable, but it certainly shouldn't be negative. It shouldn't be hard work or something that's difficult to do. So maybe that's even ideally, speaking can be fun. That it, I think for people who stutter, in my experience, I don't think I'll ever take speaking fluently for granted, or being able to tell a joke or talking to somebody on a plane. Or, I mean, I don't, I think a lot of people would take that for granted, but if you've not been able to do that for a couple decades of your life, I think you are likely to appreciate it. So maybe they won't have all neutral statements, but some people maybe ideally would have slightly more origin than bond statements. It depends on the situation, I suppose.
Yeah. Either way, the tool that we've developed hopefully will aid clinicians and researchers in attempting to measure that. So now we're going to talk about the last presentation, which is called Covert Stuttering, a Foucauldian Analysis. And I talked about this with Peter a couple of episodes ago, so I'm not going to go into too much detail about my research in passing as fluent, but this will be a presentation where I'll be discussing the recent work that I've been doing with people who pass as fluent speakers, and I'll be giving some examples from my data, which I didn't have a chance to do when I was talking with Peter, but I think hearing the words of the people who are experiencing this themselves are quite powerful. So I think that's what people tend to get the most out of this presentation, is just seeing some of the interview transcripts and hearing how people who pass as fluent are describing their experiences. So what motivated me to start to look into this phenomena was that from how we talk about covert stuttering, it's almost taken for granted as inherently negative. It's talked about as an unfortunate consequence of either people's shame or of a social stigma or your self-esteem issues. And given how much people with disabilities are discriminated against and how much ableism is present in society, it seemed to me that there might be other reasons why people would want to pass as fluent. So I wanted to investigate how people were constructing this subject position as people who covertly stutter or people who pass as fluent. And I think the main thrust of my work is that there's a reason people do this. And the reason is that there's certain privileges that they're entitled to as fluent speakers that they don't think they would be receiving as people who stutter. And to me, that doesn't sound like a pathological issue. That sounds like a social issue, that certain subject positions, the stuttered subject position, is construed as inferior to the fluent subject position. And people who pass as fluent are trying to access that privilege. So it's almost, it, in that sense, it's a fairly agentic move. I think what brings people into therapy, if they're people who pass as fluent, is that some move that they've done stops opening up more choices and starts shutting down choices. I think it all returns to what we were talking about earlier with agency. If you've been trying to live your life fluently and that ends up limiting you, then nobody wants to be limited in their lives. Everybody wants to have as many options open to them as they can have. So I think the same with any other people who come to you for therapy. So what you're trying to do is look at the practices that they're doing to construct this identity and try to figure out the practices that they can be doing to achieve as much freedom as possible.
Can I just interject something here? I have very little to do with this particular study, other than supporting Chris to go off and do something that was about as unique as anything I've come across since I've been in the field all these years. But I do think there was a real need for more of an in-depth, in this case, qualitative study. I don't think there's ever been a qualitative study about covert stuttering because it's so hard to define. But
there was.
Oh, that's right.
Jill Douglas did her dissertation. I have not seen published work yet out of that, but she looked at the coming out process.
That's right. I'd forgotten about Jill's dissertation. But I will venture to say, and this is just a sense I would have, I guess, that I think when this comes out, it's going to have a sea change in terms of the understanding of the meaning of what we've called interiorized or covert stuttering. I don't think anybody's ever investigated it in depth, partly because these people, till kind of recently on the internet, were hard to identify, or they, of course, self-identify, and it's a kind of a nebulous term. I think everybody who stutters is covert to the best of their ability, but these people are exquisitely good at it, from what I understand, better than I ever was. And there's a price to pay, and I think that Chris is understanding the dynamics of that, and I think it's going to be a very impactful manuscript once it's out there.
And you bring up a really good point that Peter brought up the last time that I talked with him, which was that we don't really have a good word for this yet. And he was suggesting passing as fluent as a superior description to what's happening than covert stuttering. And I have to agree with him. It's just that before we had that conversation, I had put in my application for the conference. So on the workshop, it'll say covert stuttering. But I think what you were just talking about, how a lot of people who stutter try to hide it. And I think all those things that every person who stutters is doing to attempt to hide it, maybe that's a better word for covert stuttering. And the actual phenomena of living your life as a fluent speaker, even though you have a stutter, would be more appropriately called passing as fluent. And that was one of the issues that I had when I was doing research into the literature, was that people used covert stuttering to describe those things that everybody does, and some other people used it to describe passing as fluent. And if you go across the ocean, they use interiorized stammering. So there was a discrepancy in what we were calling, what we were talking about. And I think that's also one of the things that sort of made it difficult to research, is that it's kind of slipped through the cracks because people weren't consistently talking about it in a certain way. I also think, unfortunately, a lot of people don't take it very seriously because they almost look at it as a severity issue. And I would avoid doing that. I don't think it has anything to do with severity. I guess also because I'm not taking a medical view of the problem, it doesn't really make any sense to talk about severity. But I think it's been to passing as fluent disadvantage that a lot of people have seen it as less severe overt stuttering. And therefore, they thought it didn't have a big impact on the person's life. And I think that's completely false. A lot of people who I've talked to, this had just as big of an impact, if not a bigger impact, on their life than a lot of people who overtly stutter, who if you were to give them an SSI, would be severe, but if you gave these people an SSI, they'd probably be pretty mild. So I think that's another reason why it hasn't been researched, is that it's been mistakenly seen as as a severity issue.
Interesting.
Okay, well, I think we have summarized our talks, and I know that I'm really looking forward to being at the conference, and I'll be doing some other interviews with people while I'm there. And I think the thing that I am looking forward to the most is just talking to people who come from different backgrounds and from different places about their experience with stuttering and their perspective on stuttering. Because I think it's, when you work in a certain area, you kind of talk to the same people over and over, and you hear the same perspectives over and over. And I'm really looking forward to hearing new and exciting perspectives, because I think I can grow from them. What are you most looking forward to?
Olives.
And wine.
It's time to have one of olives. No, like I said earlier, I'm looking forward to seeing friends we have from England and the Netherlands in particular, but also meeting people who I've read about or meeting people who I've even seen before. But, seeing old friends and making new friends in the field, I think that's one of the been probably the highlight of maybe the best part of my career, is the ability to do that, is to meet all these kind of more or less like-minded people from around the world who are out to help people who stutter. And it's really been a wonderful experience doing that. I never imagined it, that aspect of it initially, but it's been very rewarding. So looking forward to that.
All right. Well, thank you for talking with me.